Campus FM presents A Book, A Thousand Stories. A review of the book, The Hare with Amber Eyes, by Edmond de Waal. Production and presentation, Patricia Salomone. Musical advice by Gerald Fennec, and technical support by Samuel Attard and Carmelo Grech. We have now reached the fourth episode of this programme, A Book, A Thousand Stories, and I guess that by now, as we move from one character to the next, from one story to the other, you have grasped the reason why I chose this title in making this review of Edmond de Waal's book, The Hare with Amber Eyes. So now we go back to the Paris of the Belle Époque. Imagine now the mundane collector Charles Efroussi working at the layout of his study on Dürer, surrounded by an incredible array of beautiful objects in his study in the Rue de Monceau on the golden Parisian hill. He has been vagabonding between museums in European capitals and secondary towns, rummaging among known and unknown private collections in search of the least known of Dürer designs. He sincerely believes that all of Dürer's drawings, even the lightest of sketches, merited a special mention, that nothing that was attributed to the hand of our master should be omitted. It was important to catch the thought of the artist in all its freshness at the very moment of manifestation. Charles works hard at writing the book to make better known in France the greatest German artist, but also because he firmly believes that different ages informed each other and that a sketch by Dürer could talk to a sketch by Degas.
Germans refer to the years around 1500 as the Age of Dürer, and thereby equate the painter's name with a glittering period in their art. Albrecht Dürer, humanist, court artist and printmaker, was the giant of the German Renaissance, who gave his paintings a sense of equilibrium and clarity previously lacking in Northern art. Dürer lived and worked mostly in the powerful city of Nuremberg. His corpus of works is dominated by beautifully coloured portraits of intellectuals, church doctors, and princely figures, as well as devotional images. Between 1511 and 1514, he brought out three substantial woodcut cycles and became famous for his handling of black and white in his graphic works. In 1514, his masterpiece engravings of Night, Death, and the Devil, St. Jerome and Melanchonia I took the art world by storm, and the precision of these works with their masterful fine lines remains unsurpassed even today. It is also worth mentioning Dürer's watercolour landscapes at this point, as they have a remarkable spontaneity and freshness that make them close in spirit to the plein air compositions of Impressionism. Dürer introduced a new way of looking at nature and succeeded in capturing an atmospheric content never seen before in painting. He is reputed to be the first artist to utilize the words landscape artist with reference to a contemporary of his, Patinir. Dürer famously said, "For verily art is embedded in nature. Whoever can draw her out has her." De Waal tells us in his book that Dürer was the first artist that Charles F. Frissy fell in love with as a young man in Vienna, and published a book on the artist's life called Albert Dürer, Essai Dessin, in 1882. It is tempting to think that the qualities inherent in Dürer's watercolours spoke to Frissy in the same way that the paintings of his Impressionist friends did. When De Waal informs his reader that a sketch by Dürer could possibly talk to a sketch by Degas, he probably meant to say that a drawing by the greatest German artist of the past could be fully understood by Degas, the new genius of printmaking. Degas was, of course, the French painter and sculptor who mainly focused on painting women who earned their living dancing, singing or acting in the Paris of La Belle Époque. He was also an innovative printmaker, and from 1876 to early 1880, looked out for new ways to replicate the texture of his paintings in his prints. Degas was one of the finest and most creative printmakers of his age, and greatly admired by Picasso, another great artist. Charles perhaps understood that a drawing, a sketch, or a print captures the initial thought of an artist, sometimes better than a finished masterpiece. Dürer, the past master of the medium, could in fact speak to Degas, the present master, because they shared the same moment of truth in the initial act of creation, and that the two could have had a conversation as expert printmakers.
In his restless work, Charles has a young assistant, the poet Jules Lafogu, who calls him the Benedictine dandy of Rue de Monceau. Lafogu adores him, teases him. He is anxious to prove himself in this his first job. He writes several letters which are witness to their profound friendship. Charles arranges for the young poet to get a job in Berlin as a reader of French to the Empress. A letter by Lafogu to his benefactor is, to our author De Waal, a great fount of information. It reads, "Every line in your beautiful book recalled so many memories, especially the hours spent alone working in your room, where the note of a yellow armchair bursts out. And the Impressionists." From this letter, in which Lafogu goes so enthusiastic, writing about the paintings adorning the walls of Charles's study, De Waal learns, and we learn, who are Charles's protégés, which are his favourite artists, and what he chooses to surround himself with. There are two fans by Pissarro, constructed of painstaking small strokes. There are the Sisleys showing the Seine, and not omitting the telegraph wires against the sky in springtime. There is a Renoir's little savage girl, La Bohémienne, and Berthe Morisot's Mother and Child, with a black pet dog and a butterfly net. There also hangs Renoir's famous Parisienne with red lips and a blue jersey, alongside Mary Cassatt's bare-shouldered dancer. There also are the nervous dancers by Degas and Manet's Polichinelle. Isn't this incredible, then, an art collector's dream? Thank you. As editor of the Gazette des Beaux-Arts, Charles advocates for the living artists, many of whom are his personal friends. Passionate and partisan, he is buying pictures for the room with the yellow armchair. In 3 years, he puts together a collection of 40 Impressionist works, and he buys 20 more for his Bernstein cousins in Berlin. All these modern works hang in his splendid apartment in the Rue de Monceau, alongside the Donatello and the Della Robbia faun. By now, Charles is an audacious and prominent art critic and editor. His patronage of the new artists, still seen as charlatans by established academicians, is precious. He is their friend, an older brother to young artists. Like him, many are Japanism enthusiasts. And just as their works share Charles's study with the Netsuke collection, their work shares the quality of everyday life in common with Japanese art. A peddler scratching his head, a woman with a crying child, a dog wandering off to the left. De Waal tells us that Emile Zola wrote, "This art of simplification is to be likened to that of the Japanese prince. They resemble it in their strange elegance and magnificent patches of color." Charles is an expert. He understands his friend's radicalism, both in technique and subject matter. He spends time with the artists, joins them and their friends and their gay ladies from the music halls as they go boating along the Seine, and he is immortalized in the painting Le Déjeuner des Canotières by Renoir, who believes patrons and critics are necessary somewhere alongside great painters. You may have in mind that happy, airy painting by Renoir, which shows the artists and poets enjoying food and wine very casually at La Maison Fournaise on the Seine. Well, the gentleman in a dark suit who stands rather awkwardly in the background is, in fact, Charles, their patron and friend. Among the carefree Bohemian crowd of friends, Charles is clearly out of place, but he is a sitter, friend and patron, and he is there. Charles Frussi, or at least the back of Charles's head, enters art history. But Charles will move on, his artistic flair taking him to new horizons, to the flashy and gold encrusted works of Gustave Moreau. This brings him heavy criticism for the newly settled rich Jews, seen as flashy nouveau riche, fascinated by gold in all its forms. To Charles, the Moreau paintings have the quality of an ideal dream.
art of Gustave Moreau stands apart from that of his realist and impressionist contemporaries in 19th century France. His biblical and mythological paintings possess a mysterious and, indeed, the enigmatic quality of an ideal dream. For this reason, he is considered by some to be a precursor to both the symbolist and the surrealist movements in art. Although his exotic Salome, which portrays the Judean princess dancing before her stepfather Herod, caused quite a sensation when it was exhibited at the 1876 Salon, it also showed Moreau to be very much out of step with the realistic currents in art in 1860s and 1870s France. Whilst Moreau deliberately elected to use an archaic and classically inspired style promoted by the French Academy, painters of modern life, such as Degas and Manet, scorned Moreau for being anti-naturalistic. The artist was a philosophically disposed painter, and his canvases reflected an almost floating world of inner sensations and the subconscious. The Chimera, which shows a nude female being transported by a winged centaur, is a philosophical meditation on the internal nature of women. There is also an element of erotic contemplation in works like Galatea, which belonged to Charles Effussy's extensive collection of artworks, and depicts a languid female figure reclining in a rocky landscape, dreaming of a cyclops, who appears, in turn, to be also dreaming of her. Moreau's use of gold, traditionally used in art for icons and illuminated manuscripts, fits in perfectly with the notion that La Belle Époque had indeed become a gilded and glittering age of opulent luxury. It also reflects his individual patron's considerable wealth. Charles Effussy's friend, the Countess Griffule, had also commissioned a painting from Moreau entitled Hélène Glorifiée in the 1890s. The final decade of the 19th century saw the influence of symbolist art spread across Europe and was not confined to just Paris. Moreau remains the best-known exponent of this reaction against realist art. Charles Effussy owned two works by the artist, and this indicates that he probably shared Moreau's fascination with legends as well as the world of inner dreams and desires. Effussy's endorsement of Moreau's art reflected the collector's changing tastes as the century drew to a close, as well as his appreciation of a new type of beauty that belonged to the realm of the imagination.
Yet, Renoir, who has been the recipient of so much patronage from Charles Effussy, writes, "Ah, oh, that Gustave Moreau, to think he is taken seriously. It was clever of him to take in the Jews, to have thought of painting with gold colors. Even Effussy fell for it, who I thought had some sense." Renoir is extremely galled to find that his patron, the editor of La Gazette, has this Guy Rothschild stuff hanging on his walls, contaminatingly close to his own paintings in the room with the yellow armchair. Ah, a Jason standing naked on the slaughtered dragon, and a Galatea illuminated by precious jewels with the dedication, "A mon ami Charles Effussy." By 1885, Charles is the owner of the Gazette. He is a busy man, a man of many abilities and activities. He writes, he curates exhibitions, he helps purchase a Botticelli for the Louvre. He is the recipient of the Legion d'Honneur for his contribution to the arts. Time for his lover Louise Guyen d'Anvers, but but also for the socially ravenous Marcel Proust, who dedicates his translation of Ruskin's Bible of Amiens to Monsieur Charles Effroussi, always so good to me. La Fougue is but the first of a long list of young men who have worked closely with Charles, charmed by the atmosphere of his magic, cavern-like study with its yellow armchair, the Berthe Morisots, the Renoirs, the Moreaus, and the Della Robbia. They are intense relationships, a sharing of like minds. Perhaps, suggests Lowell, there is some truth in the Parisian society gossip that Charles was quite comfortable entre deux lits. But times are changing. A string of financial scandals throughout the 1880s were laid at the door of the new Jewish financiers, and the Effroussi family were a particular target. The Effroussi, les rois du blé, are simultaneously loathed as upstarts and feted as patrons. They felt they belonged in Paris, but many people shared Edouard Drumont, editor of the anti-Semitic La France's Juifs opinion, who saw them as Jews vomited from the ghettos of Europe, now installed as the masters of the history houses of France. The Rothschilds are everywhere. The Effroussi installed at Fontainebleau in the palace of François Ier. This class of financiers is seen as venal, and even Charles is vilified as one who operates in the world of literature and art. His very book on Dürer is scrutinized for Semitic tendencies. Charles is aging, and his taste is refining, changing from Japonism to French 18th century, and to the productions of Meissen and of Sèvres. After his mother's death, he has moved with his bachelor brother Ignace from the Rue de Monceau to a new larger home on the Avenue de Jena, a new area even grander than the Rue de Monceau. Has replaced his lit de parade with an empire bed, those little boat-shaped beds which looked as if they were floating on the Nile. It is a lit à la polonaise, hung with silks. All this porcelain, the Savonnerie carpets, the paintings by Boucher, the boiserie and the tapestries speak of the need of the Effroussi family to settle seamlessly into society. Charles's new French Empire-style home is an affirmation, a claim to his Frenchness. Empire is not Le Goût Rothschild, not Jewish, it is French. Les Effroussi have been in Paris for 20 years. Now they make it clear that they are here to stay. In the business world and in diplomacy, Effroussi et Compagnie wielded extraordinary power. They had the money and knew how to use it, caring little that speculation, the making of money out of money, is seen as a particular Jewish sin. And they used their potency as a weapon, threatening to flood the market with grain in response to Russian pogroms. They made Russia hold her hand in the last Jewish persecution by reducing Russian securities 24 points in 13 days. Touch another of our people, and not another ruble will you have to save your empire, said Michel Effroussi, head of the great house at Odessa, the largest grain dealers in the world. The Effrussi were, in short, very rich, very visible, and very partisan. We shall follow their splendid dance through life at the change of the 19th to the 20th century when we meet again next week. Grateful to Caroline Lejani for her expert contribution to this episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories.